For me, science wasn't about the big picture, but the small one. The same modestly ambitious hunt-and-peck investigations that Jonas decried as a waste of time. And yet, his passion was attractive, even in its own crackpot way, inspiring. Who wouldn't want to live forever? "The thing I don't get is why he thinks the way he does," I said. "He seems so sensible otherwise." My tone was light, but I could tell I'd hit on something. Liz called the waiter over and asked for another glass of wine. "Well, there's an answer for that," she said. "I thought you knew."
"Knew what?"
"About me." This was how I came to learn the story. When Liz was 11, she had been diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. The cancer had originated in the lymph nodes surrounding her trachea. Surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. She'd had it all. Twice she'd gone into remission, only to have the disease return. Her current remission had lasted 4 years. "Maybe I'm cured, or so they tell me. I guess you never know." I had no idea how to respond. The news was deeply distressing, but anything I might have offered would have been an empty platitude. Yet, in a way I could not put my finger on, the information did not seem entirely new to me. I had felt it from the day we'd met. There was a shadow over her life. "I'm Jonas's pet project, you see," she continued. "I'm the problem he wants to solve. It's pretty noble when you think about it." "I don't believe that," I said. "He worships you. It's totally obvious." She sipped her wine and returned it to the table. "Let me ask you something, Tim. Name one thing about Jonas Lear that isn't perfect. I'm not talking about the fact that he's always late or picks his nose at traffic lights. Something important." I searched my thoughts. She was right. I couldn't. "This is what I'm saying. Handsome, smart, charming, destined for great things. That's our Jonas. Since the day he was born, everybody's loved him. And it makes him feel guilty. I make him feel guilty. Did I tell you he wants to marry me? He tells me all the time. Say the word, Liz, and I'll buy the ring. Which is ridiculous. Me, who might not live past 25, or whatever the statistics say, and even if the cancer doesn't come back, I can't have children. The radiation took care of that." It was getting late. I could feel the city changing around me, its energies shifting. Down the block, people were stepping from the theater, hailing cabs, going in search of drinks or food. I was tired and overloaded by the emotions of the last few days. I signaled the waiter for the bill. "I'll tell you something else," Liz said as we were paying the tab. "He really admires you." This was, in some ways, the strangest news of all. Why would he admire me? Oh, a lot of reasons. But I think it comes down to the fact that you're something he can't ever be. Authentic, maybe? I'm not talking about being modest, although you are. Too modest, if you ask me. You underestimate yourself. But there's something, I don't know, pure about you. A resilience. I saw it the moment I met you. I don't mean to put you on the spot. But the one good thing about cancer, and I mean the only thing, is it teaches you to be honest. I felt embarrassed. I'm just a kid from Ohio who did well on his SATs. There's nothing interesting about me at all. She paused, gazing into her glass, then said,
I've never asked you about your family, Tim, and I don't mean to pry. All I know is what Jonas has told me. You never mention them. They never call. You spend all your breaks in Cambridge with this woman and her cats. I shrugged. She's not so bad. I'm sure she isn't. I'm sure she's a saint, and I like cats as much as the next person, in the right quantity. There's not really much to tell. I doubt that very much. A silence followed. I discovered that swallowing took a great deal of effort. My windpipe felt as if it had constricted. When at last I spoke, the words seemed to come from another place entirely. She died. Behind her glasses, Liz's eyes were intently fixed on my face. Who died, Tim? I swallowed. My mother. My mother died. When was this? It would all come out now. There was simply no stopping it. Last summer. It was just before I met you. I didn't even know she was sick. My father wrote me a letter. And where were you? With the woman and her cats? Something was happening. Something was coming undammed. I knew that if I didn't move immediately, stand up, walk around, feel the beating of my heart and the action of air in my lungs, I would fall apart. Tim, why didn't you tell us? I shook my head. I felt suddenly ashamed. I don't know. Liz reached across the table and gently took my hand. Despite my best efforts, I had begun to cry. For my mother, for myself, for my dead friend Lucchesi, whom I knew I had failed. Surely I could have done something, said something. It wasn't the note in his pocket that told me so. It was the fact that I was alive and he was dead, and I of all people should have understood the pain of living in a world that didn't seem to want him. I did not want to take my hand away. It felt like the only thing anchoring me to the earth. I was in a dream in which I was flying and could not make myself land. Were it not for this woman, who would save me? It's all right, Liz was saying. It's all right. It's all right. Time moved then. We were walking. I didn't know where. Liz was still holding my hand. I sensed the presence of water, and then the Hudson emerged. Decrepit piers jutted long fingers into the water. Across the river's broad expanse, the lights of Hoboken made a diorama of the city and its lives. The air tasted of salt and stone. There was a kind of park along the water's edge, filthy and abandoned looking. It did not seem safe, so we headed north along 12th Avenue, neither of us speaking, before turning east again. I had given no thought at all to what would happen next, but now began to. In the last hour, Liz had spoken of things that I felt certain she had told no other person, just as I had done with her. There was Jonas to think of, but we were also a man and a woman who had shared the most intimate truths, things that, once said, could never be unsaid. We arrived at the apartment. No words of consequence had passed between us for many minutes. The tension was palpable. Surely she could feel it, too. I couldn't say for certain what I wanted, only that I didn't want to be away from her. Not for a minute. I was standing dumbly in the middle of the tiny room, searching my mind for the words to capture how I felt. Something needed to be said. And yet I could say nothing. It was Liz who broke the silence. Well, I'm going to turn in. The sofa folds out. There are sheets and blankets in the closet. Let me know if you need anything else. Okay.
I could not make myself move toward her, though I wanted to, very badly. On the one hand, there was Liz, and all we had shared, and the fact that, in every way, I loved her, and probably had since the day we'd met. On the other, there was Jonas, the man who'd given me a life.
Your friend, Lucchesi. What was his first name?
I actually had to think.
Frank, but I never called him that. Why do you think he did it?
He was in love with somebody. She didn't love him back. Not until that moment had this chain of thought, in all its starkness, come clear to me. Call Fanning, my friend had written. Call Fanning to tell him that love is all there is, and love is pain, and love is taken away.
What time is the car? She asked.
8 o'clock.
I'm going with you, you know.
I'm glad you are. A frozen moment passed.
Well,
Liz said,
I guess that's it.
She retreated to the bedroom door, where she paused and turned to face me again.
Stephanie is a lucky girl, you know. I'm just saying that in case you haven't figured it out.
Then she was gone. I stripped to my boxers and lay on the couch. Under different circumstances, I might have felt foolish, daring to think that such a woman would take me into her bed. But I actually felt relieved. Liz had chosen the honorable route, making the decision for both of us. It occurred to me that not once, neither at the restaurant nor as we'd walked, had I thought of Stephanie in the context of any betrayal I might have contemplated. The day felt like a year. Through the windows, I heard the wash of the city, an oceanic sound. It seemed to creep into my chest, where it matched itself to the rhythm of my breathing. Exhaustion poured through my bones, and soon I drifted off. Sometime later, I awoke. I had the unmistakable sense of being watched. A sensation, vaguely electrical, lingered on my forehead, as if I had been kissed. I rose onto my elbows, expecting to see someone standing over me. But the room was empty, and I thought I must have dreamed this.
About the funeral, there is little to say. To describe it in detail would be a violation of its confidential grief, its closed circuit of pain. During the service, I kept my eyes on Ariana, wondering what she was feeling. Did she know? I wanted her to know, but I also didn't. She was just a girl. No good could come of it. I declined the family's invitation to lunch. Liz and I returned to the apartment to retrieve my luggage. On the platform at Penn Station, she hugged me. Then, revising her thoughts, kissed me quickly on the cheek.
So, okay?
I didn't know if she meant me or the two of us.
Sure, I said. Never better.
Call me if you get too blue. I stepped aboard. Liz was watching me through the windows as I made my way down the car to find an empty seat. I remembered boarding the bus to Cleveland that long ago September day, the drops of rain on the window, my mother's crinkled bag in my lap, looking to see if my father had stayed to watch my departure, finding him gone. I took a seat beside the window. Liz had yet to move. She saw me, smiled, waved. I waved back. A deep, mechanical shudder. The train began to move. She was still standing there, following my carriage with her gaze, as we entered the tunnel and disappeared. 18. May 1992. The last of my coursework had been completed. I was to graduate summa cum laude. Offers of generous graduate fellowships had come my way. MIT, Columbia, Princeton, Rice, Harvard, which had decided it had not seen the last of me if I cared to stay on. It was the obvious choice, one I felt bound to make in the end, though I had not committed, preferring to savor the possibilities for as long as I could. Jonas would be going back to Tanzania for the summer, then heading to the University of Chicago to start his doctoral work. Liz would be going to Berkeley for her master's in Renaissance literature. Stephanie was returning to Washington to work for a political consulting firm. The graduation ceremony itself would not happen until the first week of June. We had entered another time, a caesura between what our lives had been and what they would become. In the meanwhile, there were parties, lots of them, roiling keggers, black tie balls, a garden fete where everyone drank mint juleps and all the girls wore hats. In my trusty battle tux and pink tie, wearing it had become a trademark, I danced the Lindy, the electric slide, the hokey pokey, and the bump. At any given hour of the day, I was either drunk or hungover. An hour of triumph, but it came at a cost. For the first time in my life, I felt the pain of missing people I had not yet left. The week before graduation, Jonas, Liz, Stephanie, and I drove down to the Cape, to Liz's house. No one was talking about it, but it seemed unlikely that the four of us would be together again for some time. Liz's parents were there, having just opened the house for the season. I had met them before, in Connecticut. Her mother, Patty, came across as a bit of a society doyenne, with a brisk, somewhat phony graciousness and a lock-jawed accent. But her father was one of the most likable and easygoing people I'd ever met. A tall, bespectacled man, Liz had gotten his vision, with an earnest face. Oscar Maycomb had been a banker, retired early, and now, in his words, spent his days noodling around with money. He worshipped his daughter. That was plain to anyone with eyes. Less apparent, though undeniable, was that he vastly preferred her to his wife, whom he regarded with the bemused affection one might give to an overbred poodle. With Liz, the man was all smiles. The two of them would frequently chatter away in French, and his warmth extended to anybody in her circle, including me, whom he had nicknamed Ohio Tim. The house, in a town called Osterville, stood on a bluff overlooking Nantucket Sound. It was enormous, room upon room, with a wide back lawn and rickety stairs to the beach. No doubt it was worth many millions of dollars, just for the land alone, though in those days I had no ability to calculate such things. Despite its size, it had a homey, unfussy feel. Most of the furniture looked like you could pick it up for pennies at a yard sale. In the afternoons, when the wind swung around, it tore through the house like the offensive line of the New York Giants. The ocean was still too cold for swimming, and because it was so early in the season, the town was mostly deserted. We spent our days lying on the beach, pretending not to be freezing, or lazing around on the porch, playing cards and reading, until evening arrived and the drinks came out. My father might have had a beer before dinner while he watched the news on television, but that was the extent of it. My mother never drank at all. In the Maycomb household, cocktail hour was religion. At 6 o'clock,
Everyone would gather in the living room, or, if the evening was pleasant, on the porch, whereupon Liz's father would present us with a silver tray of the evening's concoction. Whiskey old-fashions, Tom Collins's, vodka martinis in chilled glasses with olives on sticks, accompanied by dainty porcelain cups of nuts warmed in the oven. This was followed by ample quantities of wine with dinner, and sometimes whiskey or port afterward. I had hoped our days on the Cape would give my liver a chance to recuperate. There was no chance of that. Jonas and I were sharing a bedroom, the girls another, located at opposite ends of the house with Liz's parents in between. When we'd come here during the academic term, we'd had the place and our choice of sleeping arrangements to ourselves. But not this time. I'd expected that the situation would lead to a certain amount of creeping around in the wee hours. But Liz forbade it. "Please do not shock the grown-ups," she said. "We'll all be shocking them soon enough." Which was just as well. By this time I had begun to tire of Stephanie. She was a wonderful girl, but I did not love her. There was nothing about her that made this so. She was in every way deserving. My heart was simply elsewhere, and it made me feel like a hypocrite. Since the funeral in New York, Liz and I had not spoken of my mother, or her cancer, or the night when we had walked the city streets together, but in the end had chosen to step back from the abyss and keep our allegiances intact. Yet it was clear that the night had left its mark on both of us. Our friendship, until that time, had flowed through Jonas. A new circuit had been opened, not through him, but around him, and along this pathway pulsed a private current of intimacy. We knew what had happened. We had been there. I had felt it, and I was sure she'd felt it too, and the fact that we'd done nothing only deepened this connection, even more than if we'd fallen into bed together. We would be sitting on the porch, each of us reading one of the mildew-smelling paperbacks left behind by other guests. We would look up at just the same moment. Our eyes would meet. An ironic smile would flash at the corners of her mouth, which I'd return in kind. "Look at us," we were saying to each other. "Aren't we the trusty twosome? If only they knew how loyal we are, we should get a prize." I intended to do nothing about this, of course. I owed Jonas that much and more. Nor did I think Liz would have welcomed the attempt. The connection she shared with Jonas, one of long history, ran deeper than ours ever could. The house, with its endless warren of rooms and ocean views and shabbily genteel furnishings, reminded me how true this was. I was a visitor to this world, welcomed and even, as Liz had told me, admired, but a tourist nonetheless. Our night together, though indelible, had been just that, a night. Still, it thrilled me just being around her, the way she held her drink to her lips, her habit of pushing her glasses to her forehead to read the smallest print, how she smelled, which I will not attempt to name, because it wasn't like anything else. Pain or pleasure? It was both. I wanted to bathe in her existence. Was she dying? I tried not to think about it. I was happy to be near her at all, and accepted the situation as it stood. 2 days before our departure, Liz's father announced that we would be eating lobsters for dinner. He did all the cooking. I'd never seen Patty so much as fry an egg. This was for my benefit. He had learned, to his alarm, that I had never eaten one. He returned from the fish market in the late afternoon bearing a sack of squirming red-black monsters, removed one with a carnivore's grin, and made me hold it. No doubt I looked horrified, Everyone had a good laugh, but I didn't mind. I loved her father a little for it, in fact. A lazy rain had been falling all day, sapping our energy. Now we had a purpose. As if in acknowledgement of this fact, the sun emerged in time for the festivities. Jonas and I carried the dining table out to the back porch. I had noticed something about him. In the last couple of days, he had adopted a manner I could only describe as secretive. Something was afoot. At the cocktail hour, we drank bottles of dark beer, the only proper accompaniment, Oscar explained. Then on to the main event. With great solemnity, Oscar presented me with a lobster bib. I had never understood this infantile practice. No one else was wearing one, and I felt a bit resentful, until I cracked a claw and sprayed lobster juice all over myself, to an explosion of table-wide hilarity. Imagine the perfection of the scene. The table with its red checkered cloth, the ridiculous bounty of the feast, the golden sunset streaming toward us across the sound, then sinking into the sea with a final flash like an elegant gentleman tipping his hat in farewell. The candles came out, polishing our faces with their flickering glow. How had my life led me to such a place, among such people? I wondered what my parents would have said. My mother would have been pleased for me. Wherever she was, I hoped its rules included the power to observe the living. As for my father, I didn't know. I had severed all ties completely. I saw now how unfair I'd been and vowed to get in touch. Perhaps it was not too late for him to make my graduation. When we'd finished dessert, a strawberry rhubarb pie, Jonas clinked his glass with his fork. Everybody, if I could have your attention. He rose and moved around the table so that he was standing next to Liz. With a little grunt of effort, he turned her chair so she was facing him. Jonas, she said with a laugh, what the hell are you doing? His hand fumbled in his pocket, and I knew. My stomach plunged, then the rest of me. As he bent to one knee, my friend withdrew the small velvet box. He opened the lid and held it before her. A huge, nervous grin was on his face. I saw the stone. It was enormous, made for a queen. Liz, I know we've talked about it, but I wanted to make it official. I feel like I've loved you all my life. Jonas, I don't know what to say. She looked up and laughed uneasily. Her cheeks were flushed with embarrassment. This is so corny. Say yes. That's all you have to do. I promise to give you everything you want in life. I wanted to be ill. Come on, Stephanie said. What are you waiting for? Liz looked at her father. At least tell me he asked you first. The man was smiling, a conspirator. That he did. And what did you tell him, O wise man? Honey, it's really your decision. It's a big step, but I'll say I'm not opposed. Mom? Ever so slightly, the woman was crying. She nodded ardently, speechless. God, Stephanie moaned. I can't stand the suspense. If you don't marry him, I will. As Liz looked back at Jonas, did her eyes pause at my face? My memory says she did. Though perhaps I imagined this. Well, Jonas removed the ring from the box. Put it on. That's all you have to do. Make me the happiest man alive. She stared at it, expressionless. The damn thing was fat as a tooth. Please, said Jonas. She looked up. Yes, she said, and nodded.
My answer is yes. You really mean it? Don't be dense, Jonas. Of course I mean it.
At last, she smiled.
Get over here.
They embraced, then kissed. Jonas slid the ring onto her finger. I looked out over the water, unable to bear the scene. But even its broad blue expanse seemed to mock me.
Oh, Liz's mother cried. I'm so happy.
Now, no sneaking around tonight, you two, her father laughed. You're in separate rooms for the duration. Save it for the wedding night.
Daddy, don't be gross.
Jonas turned to her father and extended his hand.
Thank you, sir. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'll do everything in my power to make her happy.
They shook. I know you will, son. Out came the champagne, which Liz's father had kept in the wings. Glasses were filled, then raised. To the happy couple, Oscar said. Long lives, happiness, a house full of love. The champagne was delicious. It must have cost a bundle. I could barely swallow it down. I couldn't sleep. I didn't want to. As soon as I was sure Jonas was out cold, I snuck from the house. It was well after midnight. The moon, fat and white, had risen over the Sound. I had no plan, only the desire to be alone with my feelings of desolation. I removed my shoes and took the stairs to the beach. Not a breath of wind blew. The world felt stuck. The tiniest of waves lapped upon the shore. I began to walk. The sand beneath my feet was still damp from the day of rain. The houses above me were all dark, some still boarded up, like tombs. At a distance, I saw someone sitting in the sand. It was Liz. I halted, uncertain what to do. She was holding a champagne bottle. She lifted it to her mouth and took a long drink. She noticed me, then looked away. But the damage was done. I couldn't turn back now. I sat on the sand beside her.
Hey.
Of course it would be you, she said, slurring her words.
Why, of course.
She took another swig. The ring was on her finger.
I noticed you didn't say anything tonight. It's considered polite, you know, to congratulate the bride-to-be.
Okay. Congratulations.
You say that with such conviction.
She sighed mournfully.
Jesus, am I drunk? Get this away from me.
She passed me the bottle. Just the dregs remained. I wished there were more. There were times to be sober, and this wasn't one of them. I polished it off and tossed it away. If you didn't want to, why did you say yes?
With everyone staring at me, you try it.
So back out. He'll understand.
No, he won't. He'll ask and ask, and I'll eventually give in and be the luckiest woman on earth to be married to Jonas Lear.
We were quiet for a time.
Can I ask you something?
I said. She laughed sarcastically. Her gaze was cast over the sea.
Why not? Everybody's doing it.
That night in New York, I was asleep and something happened. I felt something.
Did you know?
Yes, I did. I waited. Liz said nothing.
Did you kiss me? Now why would I do a thing like that?
She was looking right at me.
Liz,
shh.
A frozen moment followed. Our faces were just a foot apart. Then she did something puzzling. She took off her glasses and put them in my hand. You know, Without these, I can't see anything. What's funny is that it's like nobody can see me either. Isn't that strange? I kind of feel invisible.
I absolutely could have done it. Should have done it long before. Why hadn't I? Why hadn't I taken her in my arms and pressed my mouth to hers and told her how I felt? Consequences be damned. Who's to say I couldn't give her just as good a life? Marry me, I thought. Marry me instead. Or don't marry anyone at all. Stay just as you are. And I will love you forever, as I do now, because you are the other half of me.
Oh, God, she said. I think I'm going to throw up.
Then she did. She turned her face away and retched onto the sand. I held her hair back as all the lobster and champagne came up and out of her.
I'm sorry, Tim.
She was crying a little.
I'm so sorry.
I lifted her to her feet. She was mumbling more apologies as I draped her arm over my shoulders. She was close to dead weight now. Somehow I managed to haul her up the stairs and prop her in a chair on the divan on the porch. I was at a total loss. How would this look? I couldn't take her up to her room, not with Stephanie there. I doubted I could have gotten her up the stairs anyway without waking the entire house. I drew her upright again and carried her to the living room. The sofa would have to do. She could always say she'd had trouble sleeping and come downstairs to read. A crocheted blanket lay across the back of the sofa. I pulled it over her. She was fast asleep now. I got a glass of water from the kitchen and put it on the coffee table where she could find it. Then took a chair to watch her. Her breathing became deep and even, her face slack. I allowed some more time to pass to be certain she would not be sick again, and got to my feet. There was something I needed to do. I bent over her and kissed her on the forehead. "Good night," I whispered. "Good night." "Goodbye." I crept up the stairs. Dawn wasn't far off. Through the open windows, I could hear the birds beginning to sing. I made my way down the hall to the room I shared with Jonas. I gently turned the handle and stepped inside. But not before I heard, behind me, the snap of a closing door. The cab rolled up the drive at 6 a.m. I was waiting on the porch with my bag. "Where to?" the driver asked. "The bus station." He glanced up through the windshield. "You really live in this place?" "No chance of that." I was putting my bag in the trunk when the door of the house opened. Stephanie came striding down the walk, wearing one of the long t-shirts she slept in. It was actually one of mine. "Sneaking off, are you? I saw the whole thing, you know." "It wasn't what you thought." "Sure it wasn't. You're a total asshole, you know that?"
"I'm aware of that, yes."
She rocked her face upward, hands on her hips.
"God, how could I be so blind? It was totally obvious."
"Do me a favor, will you?"
"Are you kidding me?
Jonas can't ever know." She laughed bitterly. "Oh, believe me, the last thing I want is to get mixed up with this mess. It's your problem."
"Feel free to think of it that way."
"What do you want me to tell them, as long as I'm being such a fucking liar?"
I thought for a moment. "I don't care. A sick relative. It doesn't really matter."
"Just tell me. Did you ever think about me in any of this? Did I even once cross your mind?"
I didn't know what to say.
"Fuck you," she said, and strode away.
I lowered myself into the cab.
The driver was filling out a slip of paper on a clipboard. He glanced at me through the rear view.
"Kinda rough, pal," he said. "Trust me, I've been there."
"I'm not really in the mood to talk, thanks." He tossed his clipboard onto the dash.
"I was only trying to be nice."
"Well, don't," I said. And with that, we drove away.
19. I left them all behind. I did not attend graduation. Back in Cambridge, I packed my belongings. 3 years later, there still wasn't much, and telephoned the biochemistry department at Rice. Of all the programs I had been accepted to, it possessed the virtue of being the farthest away, in a city I knew nothing about. It was a Saturday, so I had to leave a message, but yes, I told them, I'd be coming. I thought about abandoning my tuxedo. Perhaps the next occupant would get some use out of it. But this seemed peevish and overly symbolic, and I could always throw it out later. Waiting outside, double parked, was a rental car. As I closed my suitcase, the phone began to ring, and I ignored it. I carried my things downstairs, dropped off my key at the Winthrop House office, and drove away. I arrived in Mercy in the middle of the night. I felt as if I'd been gone for a century. I slept in my car outside the house and awoke to the sound of tapping on the window. My father.
"What are you doing here?"
He was wearing a bathrobe. He had come out of the house to get the Sunday paper and noticed the car. He had aged a great deal, in the manner of someone who no longer cared much about his appearance. He had not shaved. His breath was bad. I followed him into the house, which seemed eerily the same, though it was very dusty and smelled like old food.
"Are you hungry?" he asked me. "I was going to have cereal, but I think I have some eggs."
"That's all right," I said. "I wasn't really planning on staying. I just wanted to say hello.
Let me put some coffee on."
I waited in the living room. I had expected to be nervous, but I wasn't. I wasn't really feeling much of anything. My father returned from the kitchen with two mugs and sat across from me.
"You look taller," he said.
"I'm actually the same height. You must remember me wrong." We drank our coffee.
"So how was college? I know you just graduated. They sent me a form."
"It was fine, thank you."
"That's all you've got to say about it?"
The question wasn't peevish. He merely seemed interested.
"Mostly," I shrugged.
"I fell in love. It didn't really work out, though."
He thought for a moment.
"I suppose you'll want to visit your mother."
"That would be nice."
I asked him to stop at a grocery store so I could pick up some flowers. They didn't have much, just daisies and carnations. But I did not think my mother would mind, and I told the girl behind the counter to wrap them with some greens to make them nice. We drove out of town. The interior of my father's Buick was full of fast food trash. I held up a bag from McDonald's. A few dried-out fries rattled inside it.
"You shouldn't eat this stuff," I said.
We arrived at the cemetery, parked, and walked the rest of the way. It was a pleasant morning. We were passing through a sea of graves. My mother's headstone was located in the area for cremations, smaller headstones, spaced close together. Hers had just her name, Lorraine Fanning, and the dates. She had been 57. I put the flowers down and stepped back. I thought about certain days, things we'd done together, about being her son.
"It's not bad to be here," I said.
"I thought it might be."
"I don't come all that much."
"I guess I should." My father took a long breath.
"I really screwed this up. I know that."
"It's all right. It's all over now." I'm kind of falling apart. I have diabetes. My blood pressure's through the roof. I'm forgetting things, too. Like yesterday, I had to sew a button on my shirt and I couldn't find the scissors. So go to a doctor. It seems like a lot of trouble. He paused. The girl you're in love with, what's she like? I thought for a moment. Smart, beautiful, kind of sarcastic, but in a funny way. There wasn't one thing that did it, though. I think that's how it's supposed to be. That's how it was with your mother. I looked up into the spring day. 700 miles away in Cambridge, the graduation ceremony would be just getting rolling. I wondered what my friends were thinking about me. She loved you very much. I loved her too. I looked at him and smiled. It's nice here, I said. Thanks for bringing me. We returned to the house. If you want, I can make up your room, my father said. I left it just as it was. It's probably not very clean, though. Actually, I need to get going. I have a long drive. He seemed a little sad. Well, all right then. He walked me to my car. Where are you off to? Texas. What's there? Texans, I guess. I shrugged. More school. Do you need any money? They're giving me a stipend. I should be all right. Well, let me know if you need more. You're welcome to it. We shook hands, and then, somewhat awkwardly, embraced. If I'd had to guess, I would have said my father wasn't going to live much longer. This turned out to be true. We would see each other only 4 more times before the heart attack that killed him. He was alone in the house when it happened. Because it was a weekend, several days would pass before anybody noticed he was missing and thought to look. I got into the car. My father was standing above me. He motioned with his hand for me to roll down the window. Call me when you get there, okay? I told him I would. And I did. In Houston, I rented the first apartment I looked at, a garage studio with a view of the back of a Mexican restaurant, and got a job shelving books at the Rice Library to tide myself over for the summer. The city was strange-looking and hotter than the mouth of hell, but it suited me. We search for ourselves in our surroundings, and everything I saw was either brand new or falling apart. Most of the city was quite ugly, a sea of low-rise retail, shabby apartment complexes, and enormous, overcrowded freeways piloted by maniacs. But the area around the university was rather posh, with large, well-kept houses and wide boulevards flanked by live oaks, so perfectly manicured they looked less like trees than sculptures of trees. For $600, I bought my first car. A snot-yellow 1983 Chevy Citation with bald tires, 230,000 miles on the odometer, and a sagging vinyl ceiling I used a staple gun to reattach. I'd heard nothing from Liz or Jonas, but of course they had no idea where I was. There was a time in America when it was still possible to disappear by going left when everybody expected you to go right. With a little digging, they probably could have found me. A few well-placed calls to a few department chairs. But this presupposed that they would want to. I had no idea what they would want. I didn't think I ever had. Classes began. About my studies, there is not much to say except that they occupied me utterly. I made friends with the department secretary, a black woman in her 50s who basically ran the place. She confided to me that nobody in the department had actually expected me to come. I was, in her words, a prize thoroughbred they had bought for pennies on the dollar. To describe my fellow graduate students as antisocial
would be the understatement of the century. No lawn parties here. Their minds were utterly unfettered by thoughts of fun. They also despised me for the naked favoritism shown me by my professors. I kept my head down, my nose to the stone. I adopted the practice of taking long drives in the Texas countryside. It was windblown, flat, without meaningful demarcation, every square of dirt the same as every other. I liked to pull the car to the side of the road someplace completely arbitrary, and just look at it. The one Eastern habit I retained was reading the New York Times, and in this manner I learned that Liz and Jonas had made it official. This was in the fall of 93. A year had passed. Mr. and Mrs. Oscar Maycomb of Greenwich, Connecticut, and Osterville, Massachusetts, are pleased to announce the marriage of their daughter, Elizabeth Christina, to Jonas Abbott Lear of Beverly, Massachusetts. The bride, a graduate of Harvard, recently completed a master's degree in literature at the University of California, Berkeley, and is currently a doctoral student in Renaissance studies at the University of Chicago, where the groom, also a Harvard graduate, is pursuing a Ph.D. in microbiology. 2 days later, I received a large manila envelope from my father. Inside was another envelope, to which he'd affixed a sticky note, apologizing for taking so long to forward it. It was an invitation, of course, postmarked the previous June. I put it aside for a day. Then the next night, in the company of a bottle of bourbon, sat at the kitchen table and peeled back the flap. Ceremony to be held September 4th, 1993, St. Andrews by the Sea, Hyannisport. Reception to follow at the home of Oscar and Patricia Maycomb, 41 Seaview Avenue, Osterville, Massachusetts. In the margin was a message. Please, please, please come. Jonas says so too. We miss you terribly. Love, L. I looked at this for some time. I was sitting in the window of my apartment, facing the alley behind the restaurant with its reeking dumpsters. As I watched, a kitchen worker, a small, round-bellied Hispanic man in a stained apron, came through the door. He was carrying a garbage bag. He opened one of the dumpsters, tossed the bag inside, and closed the lid with a clang. I expected him to go back inside, but instead he lit a cigarette and stood there, inhaling the smoke with long, hungry drags. I rose from the table. I kept them in my bureau, wrapped in a sock. Liz's glasses. I had put them in my pocket that night on the beach and forgotten all about them until I was in the cab, by which time it was too late to return them. Now, I put them on. They were a little small for my face, the lenses quite strong. I sat back down at the window and watched the man smoke in the alleyway, the image distorted and far away, as if I were looking through the wrong end of a telescope, or sitting at the bottom of the sea, gazing upward through miles of water. 20. Here I must leap ahead in time, because that is what time did. I finished my degree at a quick step. This was followed by a postdoc at Stanford, then a faculty appointment at Columbia, where I was tenured in due course. Within professional circles, I became well known. My reputation increased. The world came calling. I traveled widely, speaking for lucrative fees. Grants flowed my way without difficulty. Such was my reputation. I barely had to fill out the forms. I became the holder of multiple patents, two purchased by pharmaceutical concerns for outrageous sums that set me up for life. I refereed important journals. I sat on elite boards. I testified before Congress and was, at various times, a member of the Senate Special Commission on Bioethics, the President's Council on Science and Technology, the NASA Advisory Board, and the UN Task Force on Biological Diversity. Along the way, I married. The first time, when I was 30, lasted 4 years. The second, half that. Each woman had, at one time, been my student. A matter of some awkwardness, chummy glances from male colleagues, raised eyebrows from the higher-ups, frosty exchanges with my female co-workers and the wives of friends. Timothy Fanning, that Lothario, that dirty old man, though I had not turned 40. My third wife, Juliana, was just 23 the day we married. Our union was impulsive, forged in the furnace of sex. 2 hours after she graduated, we attacked each other like dogs. Though I was very fond of her, I found her bewildering. Her tastes in music and movies, the books she read, her friends, the things she thought important. None made a lick of sense to me. I was not, like many a man of a certain age, trying to prop up my self-esteem with a young woman's body. I did not mourn the years unraveling, or fear death unduly, or grieve my waning youth. To the contrary, I liked the many things my success had brought me. Wealth, esteem, authority, good tables at restaurants and hot towels on planes. The whole kit and caboodle that history awards the conquerors. For all of these, I had time's passage to thank. Yet what I was doing was obvious, even to me. I was trying to recapture the one thing I had lost, that life had denied me. Each of my wives, and the many women in between, all far younger than I was, the age gap widening with every one I took into my bed, was a facsimile of Liz. I speak neither of their appearances, though all belonged to a recognizable physical type, pale, slender, myopic, nor of their temperaments, which possessed a similar brainy combativeness. I mean that I wanted them to be her, so I could feel alive. That Jonas and I should cross paths was inevitable. We belonged to the same world. Our first reunion occurred at a conference in Toronto in 2002. Enough time had gone by that we both managed to make no reference to my abrupt severing of the relationship. We were all, "How the hell are you?" and "You haven't changed a bit," and vowed to keep in better touch, as if we'd been in touch at all. He had returned to Harvard, of course. It ran in the family. He felt himself to be on the verge of some kind of breakthrough, though he was secretive about this, and I didn't press. Of Liz, he offered only the bare-bones professional data. She was teaching at Boston College. She liked it. Her students worshipped her. She was working on a book. I told him to say hello for me, and let it go at that. The following year, I received a Christmas card. It was one of those photograph cards that people use to parade their beautiful children, though the image showed only the two of them. The shot had been taken in some arid locale. They were dressed head to foot in khaki and wearing honest-to-God pith helmets. A note from Liz was written on the back, penned in a hurried script, as if added at the last second. "Jonas said he ran into you. Glad you're doing well." Year by year, the cards kept coming. Each showed them in a different exotic setting, atop elephants in India, posing before the Great Wall of China, standing at the bow of a ship in heavy parkas with a glacial coastline in the background. All very cheery. Yet there was something depressing about these photos, a mood of compensation. "What a great life we're having, really. Swear to God." I began to notice other things. Jonas was the same hale specimen he'd always been. But Liz was aging precipitously. And not just physically. In previous pictures, her eyes had been